I Eat Green with Bhavani, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another wonderful, beautiful Wednesday. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm thrilled to be here with you today. I've had a very busy week. As many of you know, I am working actively to help get a cooking school or a healthy living center off the ground for girls out on Long Island called Oh My Girls. And as the main chef there, I will be teaching some gluten-free classes and some vegetarian classes. And so I've been busy ordering equipment and things like that for the startup of those cooking classes. But in order to run the kitchen, every chef needs to sit through a Nassau County Health Department class. And I've taken this class before when I was in the position of chef at the Waldorf School in Garden City. I had to sit through this class. But I am now 10 years wiser, even, with my understanding of how foodborne illness is really transferred and the risks and food safety issues. And it's just so frustrating sitting in a class, listening to a health department, tell us how foodborne illness is transferred, when we know that so much of the problem is just our food system. And, you know, their answer to salmonella poisoning and how to prevent salmonella in eggs is to buy liquid eggs. And it's so frustrating. You know, instead of the thought of buying organic, range-fed chicken eggs, where the eggs are not living on top of each other, the risk of salmonella is reduced greatly. You know, and then they talk about E. coli and the risk of the strain of E. coli that our bodies cannot take. And we all who are in the food movement know that E. coli poisoning, or that the strain that can kill you, comes from cows eating corn, because their digestive systems are not supposed to be eating corn. And so it's just very frustrating because they don't at all address the problems within our food system. Even Staphylococcus, they were talking about, how to prevent it. And they're talking about sanitary conditions and hygiene and wearing gloves. Well, anyone who's heard about staph really knows that most people get it from going to a hospital where they supposedly are practicing cleanly practices, and that's the quickest place to get a staph infection, is in the hospital. So the health department has so much to learn, and there they are teaching us. There are some good things about it. Yes, of course, we need to wash our hands, but putting gloves on and then, you know, collecting money and then going back and touching the bagel is certainly not going to help. It's just so funny. So anyway, I'm sitting through 8 to 10 in the morning every day this class and just rolling my eyes and feeling so frustrated. But I'm really glad to be here today with you. I have a really exciting show planned. My guest today is Bill McKibben, who is author of, you know, over a dozen books. His latest one, called Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, is an unbelievable book that I will talk to you about as we get further into the show. But Bill is, you know, an amazing activist, environmentalist, and I'm really thrilled to have him on the show. I also have a recipe I want to share with you, and I also want to tell you what's going on in my garden. The lettuce keeps coming. I mean, some of my lettuce has started to bolt, so I've pulled all that yesterday. But most of the lettuce is still looking really great, and I have arugula more than I can eat. My Mizuna greens are still going. Tomatoes are starting to ripen. My cucumbers are not as good as I would love. I have a few, but my cucumbers did not do as well this year. explore my zucchinis, actually. My zucchinis, for some reason, the leaves are big, the plants look beautiful. Hello, everybody. I don't know what happened, but I lost you there for a little while. I'm sorry. I was talking to you about my zucchinis in the garden. I have these big, beautiful zucchini plants with beautiful flowers, but just not a lot of zucchinis. So I'm still, fingers crossed, or hoping that they're going to decide to appear, but they have not yet. And what else is going on? Yesterday I hosted the young people from the River Fund Food Pantry again, and I love when they come out. I get them into the garden, and they are the ones that harvested all my lettuce for me and helped me weed, and that was really, really a great day, you know, and then they helped prepare their lunch and enjoy a little bit of nature. So it's always wonderful to have them out here. So anyway, now I would like to share with you my recipe for the day, and it's gazpacho. And I'm making gazpacho because the garden is so plentiful, and gazpacho has a lot of room for flexibility depending on what you're harvesting. This basic recipe, I have one cucumber, one green pepper, one red pepper, one Vidalia onion, and my onions are coming in, first time I've grown onions, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, a half a jalapeno pepper, salt. I use one large can of fire-roasted tomatoes, but if you don't like the flavor of smoked, you know, fire-roasted tomatoes, you can use regular tomatoes, or if you have plenty of fresh Roma tomatoes, you can use those as well. I use 2 to 4 tablespoons of fresh dill, already chopped, and the same with 2 to 4 tablespoons of fresh parsley, juice from 1 lemon, fresh ground pepper, and if you like it thinner, you can use some organic tomato juice as well to thin that out. And basically, you are pulsing all of the ingredients into the food processor. Start with the vegetables and pulse them until they're pureed. Then you add the can of fire-roasted tomatoes. Then you add the chopped dill and parsley. And the dill and the parsley I've chopped by hand because I don't want that to be really pureed. I like to be able to still see the dill and the parsley in the soup. 1 lemon I squeeze into that, and then I season it with fresh pepper. And you can add some more salt if you'd like. And as I said, if you want the soup thinner, just add a little bit more tomato juice. And that is it. So it's so quick, so easy. And if you have some zucchini, you can puree some zucchini into there. Of course, some celery you can add into there. So you really can create a gazpacho with any of the vegetables you have coming out of the garden that are good fresh. If you have lots of greens, you can put some fresh arugula into that as well. It would be delicious. I wouldn't use eggplant uncooked. Eggplant really needs to be cooked, but the other vegetables are really great in there. And what else I would like to share with you, an article that came out this past weekend in the New York Times that I just found so disturbing. It was in the reviews section, and it was called Concealed Weapons Against the Environment. And it talked about 39 riders that are pending, that are trying to be attached to different bills that are being passed through the House. And all of them are anti-environment. And they're really disturbing. And if you go to my website, I'm going to post the link to this article, because all these different laws or, bills that have been in the works, that have been planned with the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Air Act, these riders are trying to go against and go back on them. And so it's really going in the wrong direction. So I really encourage you all to take some action. Hopefully with our guest today, with Bill on, he can tell us more about some of the things that we can do. So without further ado, I would like to invite Bill McKibben on. Bill, are you there?
Indeed I am. How are you?
Hi, Bill. Good. How are you?
Good.
Thanks so much.
We had zucchini last night.
It's amazing.
On the grill.
What's that?
On the grill.
On the grill. Perfect. Perfect. Did you marinate it first or just?
Of course.
Great. Great. Yeah, it's just so much fun in the summer to just, like, eat right from your garden.
You said it.
I'm loving it. So, I'm so happy to have you on. I love your new book, if you can say love it. I mean, it's actually kind of depressing to read it, but it's very
moving.
It's
a little better as it goes along. The first chapter is kind of a kick in the teeth.
Right, right. But it's really amazing. Now, your first book, The End of Nature,
yes.
Came out in 1989.
Long ago, 22 years ago when I was a young man.
When you were a young man. What inspired you? Like, what, you know, I don't really know that much of your history. Maybe you could share with us what brought you to the environmental movement.
Sure. I was a journalist. In fact, my first job out of college was writing the Talk of the Town column for the New Yorker magazine.
It's a pretty good first job there, Bill.
It was a good job. A great deal of fun. And then I quit and moved up to the Adirondack Mountains of New York State, which are the great wilderness of the American East, a truly transcendent and wild place. And I was deeply in love with that wilderness. And at the same time, I was reading the early scientific papers on climate change and beginning to understand that that wilderness faced a deep and profound threat, that really it was hard to talk about any wild place on this planet anymore, now that we were raising the temperature of every spot on Earth. And so that first book, The End of Nature, which was also the first book about global warming for a non-scientific audience, was equal parts reporting on this newly emerging crisis and philosophical essay about the sadness that it was engendering in me.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I'm afraid I've spent most of the last two decades in one way or another working on that crisis. It's the biggest thing that human beings have ever done by a very large measure to alter the Earth's atmosphere and then begin to see it reflected in every physical system on the planet. It represents an enormous practical crisis. So I've been writing about it ever since and increasingly organizing about it, building these large-scale grassroots climate change campaigns all across the world in an effort so far unsuccessful to really rein things in.
Yeah. Well, I know, you know, of course, many people, you know, in reading reviews and stuff, saw the correlation between when Rachel Carson came out with Silent Spring. And, you know, as a result of that, she actually got the U.S. government to ban DDT.
Yes.
And, you know, and I was wondering after End of Nature, which was also such a remarkable work, and like you said, the first book really for the general public on global warming and climate change, did you see any direct correlation coming out of as a result of that book?
No, not in the same way, and I didn't expect to because the problems are so different in scale. Mm-hmm. DDT was a real problem, and the chemical industry fought hard to, you know, avoid having to get rid of it, but it was a, you know, tiny, tiny part of America's or the world's economy. Fossil fuel, the thing that drives global warming, is the absolute center of the world's economy. It's the by far richest and most powerful industry that the world has ever seen. It's implicated in almost every act of a modern life, the consumption of fossil fuel. And hence I was under no illusions that it was going to be easy or simple. Indeed, it hasn't been. I did think that we'd probably have made more progress in 20 years than we have.
Right.
But the power of the fossil fuel industry is almost impossible to overstate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big oil companies just announced their record quarterly profits last week, and ExxonMobil made more money in the quarter than any company in the history of money.
Right, and how is that okay? I don't get it. You know, it's
well,
like, it doesn't...
Well,
make sense to everybody I know.
It doesn't make sense, certainly, to scientists who have done a very good job of sounding the alarm about climate change. They've given us the information that we need to work with, and, you know, as a result, we should be taking political action, but we're not. And the reason we're not is that, above all, is that political power. And, you know, we're never going to have enough money to beat these guys. Therefore, we need a different currency to work in. And the only one we've been able to find so far is bodies and spirit and creativity.
Mm-hmm.
We've been able to build a fairly large movement in the last 3 years around the globe at 350.org, a movement that takes its somewhat odd name from
Tell us about that. So you started this only 3 years ago?
January of 2008, myself and seven 22-year-olds at Middlebury College here in Vermont.
Uh-huh.
350 had just emerged as, I think, quite certainly the most important number in the world. Our preeminent climatologist, James Hansen at NASA, had just published a paper in that month saying any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is, as they put it, not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. That's strong language for scientists to use, obviously. Okay. And it's stronger language when you know that at every place around the world today, the atmosphere is about 392 parts per million CO2. We're already way above where we should be. That explains the array of symptoms that we're seeing of an overheating planet. And it explains what we thought was the need to go to work on a global basis. So we took that number. Now, you wouldn't normally choose a scientific data point as the rallying place for your political campaign, but it did have the great advantage, being an Arabic numeral, of translating easily across linguistic boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
350 means the same thing pretty much everywhere. And so we set to work, the eight of us, and with a certain amount of luck, not much in the way of money or anything, but with a certain amount of luck, we were able 18 months later to pull off our first big global day of action. On that day, we had 5,100 demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN called it the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. Last year, we mounted an even bigger day in October with actions in every country on Earth except North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
This September, there'll be September 24th, a third of these great days, this one called Moving Planet, and it'll focus on transportation and particularly on the bicycle, since that's a part of the solution to our problems and since it's one of the few tools that both rich and poor are make use of around the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, 350.org, you said you did 3 years ago, but you also started another organization called Step It Up 07.
That was sort of what led into this, and that worked just in the United States, and we've sort of figured out a little bit how to use the Internet and things to make things happen on the ground, and that was sort of our training camp for this big global work that we do.
Okay, so did Step It Up 07 kind of get incorporated into 350.org now?
That's right. Exactly
uh-huh.
right.
Well, I know last year my partner and I, we run the local slow food chapter here on
mm-hmm.
Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
We participated and partnered with the Sierra Club, and we did a 350.org
well, thank you so much.
Day in October. It was really great at a Restoration Farm in Bethpage.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, that's the... That's been the great pleasure of it. We've run it all along not as a kind of organization. We're a tiny little group of people, most of us like me, volunteers. But it's so it's less an organization than a campaign. And indeed, these big days of action that we do are really the equivalent of potluck suppers, you know. We just set the date and the theme, and all around the country and all around the world, people come together to make beautiful things happen, and
mm-hmm.
then we're able to take the images of those things and get them out around the world and make it more than the sum of their parts. If you ever want to go check out the the Flickr account from the website, you can look at 15 or 20,000 pictures of these things around the world. And one of the great things that you quickly realize, Vani, is that the old trope about environmentalism being something for, you know, rich white people who've taken care of their other problems just isn't true. Most of the people we work with around the world are poor, black, brown, Asian, young, because that's what most of the world, in fact, is made up of.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you know? They're just as interested in working on these problems as anybody else.
Yeah,
maybe,
one of the
maybe more so, because if you're poor, the future, you know, is pressing harder on you at the moment than it is on the rest of us.
Right. Well, I, actually, one of the things that bothers me living, you know, in a well-off area where I live is somehow I think people think that the climate crisis is just going to, like, pass over their house and not affect them.
In the case of Long Island, it may directly pass over your house. The increased possibilities for stronger hurricanes up and down the Atlantic coast are one of the things that should curl your hair. And, you know, a direct hit from a major storm on Long Island or on New York City, both of which become more possible with each passing warm year, they're events of the kind that we're really not prepared to deal with.
Right.
And they make Katrina look small by comparison, I fear.
Well, even just Monday, we had a storm here. There was hail coming down. Windshields on the expressway were breaking.
Yeah.
They closed the expressway. They closed the Northern State Parkway. They closed Hillside Avenue. There was flooding. It was unbelievable. And that was just a regular, you know, what I thought was a regular thunderstorm. But
The insurance companies tell us that the damages from storms are growing constantly. This year's the most expensive by far for them. Because we've had this epic stream of storms all across the country, including that wild flooding across the Mississippi and Missouri river basins, and including the almost unbelievable drought across the Southwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In Vermont, where I live, we've had record flooding. Lake Champlain with its highest that it's ever been recorded for a number of weeks. You know, it just goes on and on.
Right. Right. Well, one thing you said when I first met you up at Stone Barns, and I love this, you said, you know, people talk about those of us that are mobilizing and care about the environment, that we're like radicals, you know, that we're just hysterical. And you actually did a little flip on that.
No, the radicals are people who are busily changing the composition of the atmosphere, you know. Abbie Hoffman, on his most radical day, never thought of anything quite as radical as altering the composition of the atmosphere.
Right, and those are the people that are radical. So how do we explain when Congress, you know, did you see this thing that I mentioned at the beginning of the show before I had you on, concealed weapons against the environment this weekend in the New York Times? And it listed 39 riders that they're trying to sneak through, you know, in Congress, you know, that will reverse any type of protection that the Environmental Protection Agency was trying to regulate regarding greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. It will make it so that they don't have to meet certain standards in car emissions. It goes on and on. Endangered species, mountaintop mining, the Clean Water Act, coal ash. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Yeah. Well, look, our current Congress is, by every account, the worst one we've ever had, and that's saying quite a bit. They're close to crazy. I mean, they passed a resolution saying global warming doesn't exist a couple of months ago. When you begin to substitute your own ideology for physics and chemistry, you're in a big deal of trouble. It shouldn't, you know, it's always dangerous when people start drinking their own Kool-Aid, and that's what these guys are doing. And we're going to have to speak some plain truth to them. That's why, for instance, I'm in the middle of organizing with some friends this biggest environmental civil disobedience campaign in a very long time, which will happen at the end of this month in Washington. For 2 weeks, we'll be sitting in outside the White House of 50 or 100 people each day, different people each day, more than 1,000 people already signed up to risk arrest. And the target is one of the worst projects ever, this proposed pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta in Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico. It's incredibly dangerous because that tar sands in Alberta is the second largest pool of carbon on the planet. And if we develop it extensively, the NASA team, Jim Hansen, has said it's essentially game over for the climate. Barack Obama, who's much better than the Congress on these things, but nowhere near good enough, is going to get to make all by himself the decision about whether or not to grant that permit or not. He'll do it sometime this year, he said. And we need to really let him know that people are determined, bound and determined, that it not happen, that we take this strong stand against this sort of global warming. So people who are interested, and I hope a lot of people are interested, should go to tarsandsaction.org.
Can you spell that?
TARSANDSACTION.org, tarsandsaction.org. And they can sign up to come participate in what will be, we're describing it as very civil disobedience. And to get back to our point about radicals, one of the things we're telling people is we need you to be businesslike in dress and demeanor. The theory being we really want to demonstrate to people who the radicals are by display, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. And so this is over a two-week period in August.
Yes, August 20th to September 3rd. And it'll be very exciting and lots of good people helping out. Couldn't be more interesting.
Great. Well, I definitely will spread the word. So people should go and sign up, or they can just show up. They should sign up first.
Couldn't be more easier organized. You tell us what day you're coming so we'll know. We'll make sure you're well trained and taken care of and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to check out my calendar and make
sure
I'm there.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear it. That makes me very happy.
Yes, I'm definitely going to go. Are you going to be there the whole time yourself?
I'm going to be there the whole time, so I will get to meet you.
Great. Yeah. Great. Again. So tell me about the movable planet, because that's you mentioned
moving
it.
Moving planet, this thing that 350.org is doing, is going to be great fun. It's much less confrontational.
That's on September 25th?
September 24th. It'll
24th, okay.
All over the world, literally. And it's all about transportation. That's one of the drivers of our global warming problem. And one of the great solutions to it is the increased use of bicycles. And that's beginning to happen, of course, in parts of the world. I don't know if you've been, say, to cities like Copenhagen recently, but 40 or 50% of the people who commute to work in Copenhagen now do it by bicycle. It's just normal, you know. It's not sort of unusual people in outlandish spandex on expensive bikes. It's just normal people riding at a normal pace down the nice bike lanes in the side of every road to get to where they need to go. And
right.
The same thing in, you know, place after place after place. We're beginning to see some of it happen in this.
Absolutely. I don't know when the last time you were in New York, but
New York is getting better, man.
Yes, it's so exciting. I mean, there's actually bike rental places, you know,
yep,
for tourists, and there's,
yep,
bike lanes, and I know people that drive into the city that absolutely hate it because now, you know, Broadway, which is like a main thoroughfare, is down to one lane.
Anything to make it more difficult to drive is an excellent idea.
Right,
yeah,
right.
The harder it is to drive, the sooner we will come to our senses.
Yeah. You know, but at the same time, I think need to start looking at urban planning and trying to make infrastructures that work with public transportation. Because where I live, I can barely leave my house
If you think about it, the American suburb is really the worst possible design we could have come up with.
Right.
It's spread out and diffuse. It's got huge houses that use tons of energy that are far apart from each other. It's not just been a disaster environmentally. In many ways, it's been a disaster socially. America really did spend most of its wealth for the last 50 years on the project of building bigger houses farther apart from each other. And the result has been not only that environmental devastation, but, you know, Americans are far more disconnected from each other than they used to be. The average American has half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. And that means everything's more difficult, from public transportation to, you know, eating dinner with your friends and family. One of the things we've done to compensate is consume, you know, in an effort to fill up those holes in our life, but it's not working very well. The average American is significantly less happy with their life than they were in the 1950s, even though their theoretical standard of living has gone up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I have a lot more questions for you, but we're going to need to take a break, so hang tight, and we're going to take a break for a few minutes, and then we'll be back and
all right, great.
Do some more, okay?
Yep.
Thank you. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Bill McKibben, author of over 20 books, first one starting with The End of Nature in 1989, and his latest one, Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Bill, you there?
I'm here.
Hi. So we were talking before we let off about global warming issues, and one thing that came out of your Step It Up 07 campaign was a guide that kind of gave people ideas about what they can do to fight global warming in their communities. Are there some tips that you could share with everybody?
Well, there's lots of things people can do to fight global warming, and we all know them by now, you know. Changing the way we, you know, the kind of cars we drive and how much we drive, changing the kind of light bulbs we have and how much electricity we use in general, changing some of the ways we eat and thinking about local food. These are all really important. However, it must be said that the mathematics of global warming doesn't admit to a solution based mostly on individual change. The most important thing you can do as an individual is to stop being an individual and get politically involved, join others in something like 350.org. We don't have much time to deal with climate change. We'll deal with it if we deal with it at all, at least in large part by change-making systemic changes. And that's what we're working for, and I don't know whether we're going to be successful or not, but we're going to keep trying.
Right. Yeah, I know one thing that I try to raise awareness about is the connection that food has to global warming. You know, you mentioned eating local,
yeah,
but also the consumption of the amount of meat that our that this country eats, and we're a role model for so many other countries, and so as so many of the more third world countries are becoming developed countries, no longer third world countries, and they're, you know, more affluent, they are seeking to eat more the way that we have eaten in the past. And
yeah, I got to say, a lot of things can be laid at our doorstep. I have a feeling that some of that desire to eat meat is indigenous to an awful lot of places without any help from us. You know, as I travel around the world, one of the things I notice is that one of the first desires people have as they get a little money is some variety in their diet, which often means meat, which, you know. And you can't begrudge it, people, but I do think it's really important that we figure out how to try and, in our country, emulate all the traditional cuisines of the world, which have taken meat as a kind of almost a condiment, as a flavoring, as a small part of the meal, and instead of trying to instruct the rest of the world on the fact that they have to become vegans, a task I think is unlikely to succeed. I think it'd be a really good idea to try and celebrate the way that meat has been used elsewhere around the world.
Right. and also to support locally, sustainably raised meat so that we're not supporting factory farms.
No, look, if you're buying meat on the yellow raft in the supermarket, you're really hurting the cause. Factory farmed meat is a bad thing. On the other hand, we're beginning to think that grass-fed, locally raised, pastured beef may actually be a part of the solution, that that if you're intensively grazing cattle and moving them from place to place all the time, you may be creating soils rich enough to sequester more carbon and methane than those animals are producing. And the data on that's quite interesting and powerful. And, of course, since you have to use more manpower to move animals around like that, the meat will be more expensive. It'll cause us probably to eat more in the way that other people do, and it'll have the nice added benefit of probably being better for us anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, in my work, I am, I also am realistic about it, and I'm not trying to promote veganism, but I am trying to encourage people to eat less meat. And
absolutely.
As you said,
tell
use
me about
it more.
Your restaurant. I'm curious to hear about it.
Well, I don't have a restaurant. My business, I Eat Green, I am a consultant and I'm a private chef for some clients. And then I am also helping start up a school right now for girls, more like an after-school program, where we will be giving international cooking classes, cooking classes, vegetarian cooking classes, and just trying to bring back the love. Like, I love to cook.
Yeah.
And so many people think of it as drudgery, and
I love it.
Well,
I think this is actually really important. I think one of the reasons that Americans have such a bad time with food is that we've largely forgotten how to cook.
Right.
Like, literally, people don't know anymore, and hence they have no option but to go buy the crap in the center aisles of the supermarket and heat it up.
Mm-hmm.
And, everyone should have a pretty good idea how to cook, 10 or 20 good things to
absolutely. And people, and then when people see, cooking shows and so many of the dishes look so complicated, it looks scary, and one of the
also,
things
the
that I can
look
say
kind of scary too, I got to say.
Well, I'm self-taught. I never went to cooking school.
Yeah.
I love to cook and I'm an artist, and cooking became my creative outlet.
Yeah,
and
somehow almost everybody around the world through almost all of human history figured out this mystery. So,
right, it's not rocket
science.
Surely
we're up to it also, yes.
And, and so when I am with young people and I can inspire them to play in the kitchen and to create delicious food and to think about where it is, I mean, I feel like the hope is to educate young people so that they can go home and they can, encourage their parents to think about where their food's coming from, because sometimes you can't get the parents. So I feel like when I work with young people, when I go into schools, I can really make a difference. And, and I also just love to be around young people because it helps remind me the wonders of the, of the planet.
Well, food is one of the few places we're making real progress right now, and it's awfully good to see. The USDA last year said that for the first time in 150 years, there were more farms in America instead of fewer. And
right.
It's because young people are taking up farming all of a sudden, and it's remarkable to see.
Right, I loved your story about, apologizing to parents after they spent $100,000 on a child's education. And, their kids want to be a farmer.
That's it. But that's a really good thing to be.
It is a wonderful thing. And I've talked to people about that. I know, the local guidance counselor, if in high school, a child was talking to their guidance counselor around here and said they wanted to be a farmer, I know the guidance counselor would have something to be saying about that. They wouldn't really be supportive. So,
there's even on Long Island, there's more and more and more great stuff going on. I have a good friend out at the end of the island, out in Sag Harbor, one of those places.
Mm-hmm.
It's a farm called Sylvester Manor.
Oh, I know that farm. Uh-huh.
Bennett Kinesny, one of my former students, his family's been farming that farm for 15 generations, and he's now turned it into a CSA.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taken the his great gift is for music, and he's did extensive study in college of warp songs, and now he's got all the people working in his fields all have to be not just good farmers but good singers, because they sing
right.
warp songs all day long, and they have kids out there all the time to learn about what's going on. And it's
right. Well, this past April, we had our first what will be an annual small farm summit on Long Island.
Uh-huh.
And we had the folks from Sylvester Farm come out, and they did a workshop on the farm songs.
That's great.
And they provided entertainment during the farm summit. And this Friday, I'm doing a cooking demo out at Len's Winery out on the North Fork, and they will be there also doing music.
That's
this Friday.
Really interesting.
Yeah. So our paths cross. It is a small circle. Or, you know,
bigger all the time, though, and very good to see. And there are places like Vermont, where I live, where it's become not at all unusual. In fact, it's what's unusual now really is to go to a good restaurant that doesn't specialize in local food and things.
Right, right. So like you said, you know, when I met you up at Stone Barns, I mean, the food movement is heading in the right direction. We have to, you know, get more people on board, but if left to its own and time was not an issue, we would get there. So
that's right.
We all
and that's really would be the nicest way to change. You know, human beings really are designed for gradual, slow change, shifts in culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd do it. The problem with global warming is that physics and chemistry aren't allowing us the window of time that we need. We're going to have to force the spring, as the gardeners would say, and try to make things happen quickly. And
mm-hmm.
It's a question as to whether we can do it or not.
Yeah. Well, I am hopeful. I mean, one of the questions I have for you is how do you keep yourself from falling into a, you know, losing hope and falling into a well of despair? I mean, it's...
Well, sometimes I do. You know,
yeah.
I wrote a book called The End of Nature, so I'm, you know, not Pollyanna. But I find the experience of working with people all over the world now, in basically every country on Earth, invigorating. And I especially find it moving that so many of them who are working hard with us at 350.org on this problem come from places that have not caused the problem. That have no responsibility for it, and yet they're willing, even eager, to join in common cause and solidarity with people in those places that have caused almost all the problem to try and get something done. And that motivates me to keep going hard all the time.
Right. I think they say that we, as Americans, have created 40% of the greenhouse gases.
That's right. Right at the moment, about 40% of the greenhouse gases.
And what is our population
come from
percentage?
America. We're about 4% of
right.
the world's population.
Right. So it's completely imbalanced.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just really want to encourage people to join your organization, and I will do whatever I can in our slow food movement here on Long Island to make more people aware of it. And hopefully, you know, I will send you an invite to our small farm summit next year.
I'll look forward to it.
And you can visit your friends out in Sylvester Farm.
There you go.
Right. So where were you just now? I know you just got back from Europe.
Oh, I've been all over the place. Was most recently in Spain doing some work. And now I'm hunkered down here for a month getting ready for this civil disobedience stuff, and then off around the country and Europe and then Africa as the fall goes into winter. Because this is the first global problem we've ever had. And, of course, my my great irony of my life is my carbon footprint now, since I'm organizing on a global level, is very high. I'm kind of the one moving part at 350.org. And I hope that it's worth it. I hope that it we're making enough difference to make up at least for the amount of carbon I'm pouring into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you believe that writing letters and getting involved? I mean, I know you mentioned politically, and, you know, joining 350.org is definitely one way, but there's so many other...
Yeah, writing letters is terrific. You know, anything you can do, local, state, and national level. But the reason that it's important to also be involved with something like 350 is our voices mean much more when we are all saying the same thing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That gives us the chance to be loud enough to rise above the political din a little bit, and that's we found to be key.
Right. And are there local chapters of 350.org, or is it all more mobilizing on...
There are lots and lots of local, not official chapters, we don't have sort of people, but local organizers who are now of... you know, have well-established groups that they work with. So if you go to 350.org and poke around a site about moving planet, for instance, you can plug in your zip code or something, and quickly you'll find out what's going on in the neighborhood and be in touch with the people who are organizing it. And so that's, you know, we don't like meetings very much. We like action.
Right. Well, I'm definitely for that. And so I know you have a daughter in Vermont. Does she go along with you? Is she?
She's 18 now.
Uh-huh.
So she's her own woman. But she's been a very effective organizer. She came 2 years ago with me to India and the Maldive Islands in the Indian Ocean and did very good organizing.
Lucky her.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now, India is such a remarkable place to be. Right now, in many ways, the most interesting country in the world, and one that will be very important in the outcome of this problem one way or another.
Right. Because they are such a huge population.
They're growing very, very fast. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're right behind China on the escalator toward modernity. And they can make some wise choices or some not wise choices, and happily we've got lots and lots of great organizers and friends and allies there.
Wonderful. I have friends who have been going there for years and years, and they have, you know, reported back to me the changes that have been going on there are huge.
It's one of my favorite places in the world, but it is definitely in transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I have not gotten there yet, but I certainly hope to.
Yeah.
Okay, well, is there anything that you would like to share with any of my listeners before?
No, you've asked all the good questions, and, in fact, I have to go and do a organizing phone call to get ready for these things in Washington. And I hope that people will stop by, not just you, this tarsandsaction.org website, and sign up, you know. Time to start putting our bodies where our mouths have been.
Thank you. Well, I am thrilled to feel like I'm now a part of it, and I will do everything I can to work to help grow the movement.
God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you,
too.
Much, friend. Bye.
Bye. So all my listeners out there, please go to the website, tarsandaction.org, and I hope to see many of you down in Washington. I certainly will be checking my calendar and finding a day that will work for me. And write those letters. I mean, we all have to do our part. That's what you heard Bill saying. We all have to do our part. We don't have time to sit back and think others are going to address this. And it also means that we have to give up some of our creature comforts, some of the things that we're used to. And it could be scary, but we have to do it. We all have to make sacrifices for the health of the planet. So on that lovely high note, everybody, I wish you all a wonderful, wonderful, peaceful, loving rest of the week. And please keep cooking and eating with family and friends and enjoying the bounty of your garden or the farmer's market. And as I said before, I will be at the Lens Winery this Friday from 5 to 8 doing a cooking demo. And Sylvester Farm will be there, and someone from the White House Garden will be there. So they have a bunch of tables up there for this event. So I hope to see some of you out there as well. So I'm the North Fork of Long Island, And I wish you all a wonderful, peaceful rest of the week. God bless.